Hello guys, and welcome back to another episode of Dear Asian Girl. Today's episode features me and Meghna, your newest co-host.
Hello.
And we're just going to have a very chill conversational episode this week, talking about perceptions of Asian food, talking about our experience with food, like in school, outside of school, and also providing some love letters to our lunchboxes if we get time. So, Meghna, tell me about your experience with Asian food at school.
Okay, let me think. Well, I wouldn't say I had any, like, quote-unquote negative experiences like I know some other people have, bringing ethnic Indian food, ethnic Asian food to school that are, like, super prominent in my memory, but I will say that as an Indian kid going to a majority white school, I sometimes felt this sort of, I guess the best word for it would be like social anxiety. Whenever my mom would pack traditional food for me for lunch, I'm thinking dishes like lemon rice or pav bhaji or idli. I don't know. I don't remember anyone ever saying anything mean to me or anything, but or making any mean comments about what I was eating. But whenever I would take out my little tiffin box and I'd start eating my lunch, I just felt really aware of all the people around me who were eating things like pizza or peanut butter jelly sandwiches or mac and cheese. And I hyper-fixated on the contrast, on how the food they were eating was just fundamentally tasting different, smelling different than the food that I was eating. And I remember I would try to eat like discreetly. I would kind of hold my tiffin box.
Baby Meghna.
Yeah. Oh my God. I would hold my tiffin box under the cafeteria table, like, and I would try to like just try to duck under the table while I was eating. and like some dishes that are typically eaten with your hands, like idli, I would eat with a fork, so no one would like stare at me as I was eating with my hands. And I remember just even begging my parents to stop sending me Indian food for lunch and start sending me American food for lunch, whatever that means. Like the main, the main thing was this thing called Lunchables. Oh my God, I was obsessed with Lunchables as a kid. I was convinced it was the pinnacle of cafeteria cuisine. I was like, I'd get the pizza Lunchables or the Ritz cracker Lunchables. And for those of you who don't know what Lunchables are, because I honestly don't know if they still sell them in grocery stores. I haven't had them in a while. But it's basically this, like, compartmentalized box of food that you're supposed to, like, put together to create your lunch. Like, the pizza Lunchables, you'd have these circular pieces of baked dough, packet of marinara sauce and some cheese, and then you throw it together and you make a pizza. And, yeah, it was definitely not something to celebrate. But I'd strut into the cafeteria with my head held high, and I'd proudly take out my Lunchables, and I'd be like, OMG guys, look at my Lunchables. I'm so cool because I have Lunchables. And it was literally two Ritz crackers with a slice of cheese in between.
Oh yeah.
But looking back,
you'd like rip that open.
No, yeah, I was
make your pizza.
I was so excited when I had Lunchables for lunch. It wasn't even the taste that made me want to eat them so badly. Like, my mom, whatever she could make, would absolutely curb stomp Lunchables every single time. But when I ate Lunchables, it was just that feeling that I could look around and see that everyone else was also eating Lunchables. So I never felt weird or out of place or like people were judging me for eating ethnic food. And if someone asked me what I had for lunch, I could just answer the question. Like, you know, I could just say, hey, yeah, I have Lunchables. And everyone would just immediately understand what I was saying. And I wouldn't have to like explain the dish. I wouldn't have to break down the physics of a rice molecule to explain why lemon rice is yellow and not white. And it just allowed me to like blend in with everyone around me and pretend that I wasn't different, that I wasn't Indian. And it's just, looking back, I regret it so much. Like, especially now, how I'm trying to like take pride in my culture. I just wish I was able to like feel that way when I was younger.
It's interesting what you're saying about how like anxious it made you to be eating with your hands and how you'd like eat under the table and disguise it when like Lunchables, from the sounds of it, are like such a, well, we do have them in the UK. I just feel like they weren't a very big thing. But Lunchables are such a hands-on, like, DIY experience. You're using your hands, and yet you had no issue with that compared to using your hands to eat like your
Wait,
traditional
I
food.
didn't even
And
realize
that's
that.
really sad to realize. Oh,
Wait, bro,
Meghna.
wait, what?
Isn't that sad? Tragic, isn't
I
it?
literally did not even
You're
realize
going
that.
through a moment right now. Process
You
that, process
guys can't
that.
see my face, but I'm wearing the most absolute shocked expression right now.
Meghna's absolutely gobsmacked, to use a great term. Let's definitely return to this whole eating with your hands thing. But I kind of agree with what you were initially saying about not having overtly negative experiences with your lunchbox at school. I don't know if that's uncommon. I feel like I hear about a lot of stories of how Asian kids get made fun of at school
No,
for their
yeah, that's what
lunchboxes.
I was thinking
But
too.
anyway, not a bad thing to spotlight some happier stories, I guess. But while I was at school, I'm talking primary and secondary school, so that's ages of, ooh, don't even know. I'm not even gonna attempt. I don't know what age I was.
It's like equivalent
Young.
of elementary school here in the US.
Okay. But yeah, I was on free school meals. I don't know if that's a thing in the US as well, but I was one of the poorer kids basically. So we got to have what was called free school meals, and so we got our lunches provided, like hot meals. So I often ate school lunches, so things like jacket potatoes or fish and chips or roast dinner. We had pizza as well, so whatever the school provided. And actually, I didn't think about this, but maybe that does say something, that to this day, I don't think they ever really made, well, I know that they never made Chinese or Malaysian food. It was always that kind of thing. Anyway, me and all my siblings went to the same primary school and also the same secondary school. We weren't all there at the same time because of our age gaps, but every year we held this annual sports day. Don't know if that's a is that a thing for you guys?
No. I don't think we've ever had a sports day or anything. I think no, yeah, we didn't. I don't know if that was just my
So it's
school.
basically like I don't know, it just feel like a very British thing, but it's like one day a year where generally towards the end of the year, in the summer kind of, where you all go to a local track or like a big sort of area where you can do loads of different events. And everybody, at least in my school, it was compulsory. You had to sign up for at least one event, which was oh my God, I did not like that as a not very sporty kid. But yeah, it was just a day revolving around sport basically. And part of that, because you were there the whole day, meant you had to pack a lunch. And while we were in primary school, this is more like primary rather than secondary, and the sports day would just happen on our own field, within the school. The parents would come into the school and join their kids on the field, at lunchtime, and bring a picnic with them.
Oh, that's cute.
And so my mom would cook a kind of stir fry noodle dish for us.
Ooh, that sounds good.
I don't think it's an actual I don't think you can actually find it anywhere. We've just made it that way, a certain way, and we made it because it was just as good cold as it was hot, so it packed really
Oh,
well
I
to
see.
bring it to school. And it became so iconic that we actually to this day still call them the sports day noodles, and they're great and I still make them. But yeah, my primary school was just outside of West London, so it was really quite racially diverse and ethnically diverse to the point where the white students were the minority. Although I'm not gonna lie, I feel like now it's becoming more and more white. I don't know why, but it meant that sports day lunches brought in by parents were often dishes from people's own cultures, and it was very normal to bring in food from your own culture, which was really nice. And I guess inadvertently, I didn't really think about this until now, but the day became not just one that revolved around sport, but it also revolved around celebrating food, which was really nice. So that's quite a positive experience that I have around it. I don't remember really being too embarrassed about bringing in my own lunch for sports day.
No, I
But
definitely
yeah, it's a shame
think,
you guys didn't have anything like sports day.
yeah, I mean, after you explained it, I don't think we had anything like a day where we just like devoted completely to sports and everyone had to participate. I think the closest thing, like talking about how you said everyone would bring like dishes from their own cultures because there's so much diversity in your school, and it just became like a day to celebrate cultural food. I think that makes me think of this one day celebration we had in like second or third grade. It was like a cultural heritage day where everyone in the second grade would basically do some research on their culture or their ancestry if they were if their families were in the United States for generations, they'd look into their ancestry and represent that culture instead. And then everyone would dress up in cultural attire, and then they would bring like a specific dish from their culture or ancestry. And then we just have this like huge potluck or this banquet meal of all these different dishes from around the world, and it was so cool. And that was like the one day where I felt so like proud to have like a culture to represent, because like being a first generation immigrant, my culture was always surrounding me, so I didn't really have to do any research, right? I just knew all of this stuff, and I knew exactly what I wanted my mom to bring. I'm pretty sure it was chana masala. But yeah, so like when I feel like when you're surrounded by diversity, you feel less insecure about being different yourself, because then you're one of like a huge amount of people who are also different,
That is so wholesome. Oh my God. Print that on a bumper sticker and put it on my non-existent car. That sounds so cute.
Only
Oh my
wholesomeness vibes
God.
here.
Anyway, yeah. To return to what you're sort of saying about like this anxiety around eating with your hands, which I feel like is a massive thing, especially for like South Asian like kids in
Definitely.
schools. I feel like cutlery and I guess like non-cutlery is quite an important thing to discuss here. Like there's a lot of like misuse of chopsticks, for example, like not understanding that in certain cultures when you like put your chopsticks standing upright in a bowl, it's like that is like quite taboo and like unlucky.
Low
I don't know
key,
if
I
like
kind of do
this
that.
is the
I'm gonna
reason that
stop doing
circulates
that.
for everyone.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Magnemar, how dare
I
you? No, I'm kidding, it's all
I
right.
didn't know
But
that.
oh my God.
I
No, you're
apologize to
forgiven.
everybody out there.
But the reason I was given, my mom always told me that like that's what you do when it's your last meal. Or like I think she used to say like prisoners like in jail, like their last meal before they died would be like they put the chopsticks upright in their rice. Wait, is that not? And then there's also an element of like, oh, you'll get shorter if you like press down your rice. Wait, no, that's like with a spoon. Okay, that is irrelevant. Anyway, yeah, a kind of like a misunderstanding around how to respectfully use cutlery, and then also how to like be really respectful around people who don't use cutlery, which is like not unclean, obviously, because if you can eat a Lunchable with your fingers, of course you can eat your rice with your fingers. But yeah, it's always described as like dirty and uncivilized. But yeah, I want to let you talk more on that because I feel like you know a lot more than I do.
No, yeah. Thank you for pointing out the Lunchables point, because I truly did not even realize
We're back
the
to Lunchables.
hypocrisy. But yeah, I would definitely say that, especially in South Asian cuisine, a lot of our food is eaten with our hands. Rice, chapati, roti, idli, dosa. There are so many different dishes that are very prevalent in South Asian cuisine, very iconic in South Asian cuisine, and they're all eaten with your hands. And it's just typically, people, like you said, find it weird or gross that we eat dishes like rice with our hands because of, the added curry, all the different like side dishes we have. It can get quote unquote messy, even though there are a lot of Western foods that are usually eaten with your hands that also get messy. I'm thinking like hamburgers, hot dogs, sandwiches. All of it just falls out if you don't like hold it a particular angle, So I think.
Tacos.
Yeah, exactly. Like all of these dishes are eaten with hands and also get equally messy, yet no one thinks twice about those dishes. And I think it's because those foods are so like normalized in Western culture and society. No one thinks twice about eating a sandwich with your hands, and no one does this sort of double take when you see someone eating like a hot dog or a burger, when it's different with South Asian cuisine. And if I'm being completely honest, growing up, like I was kind of the same. Like confession time, I like I mentioned earlier, whenever my mom would pack me idli for lunch at school, I would literally eat it with a fork because I just felt so weird, question mark, eating it with my hands in front of my non-Indian friends and classmates especially. And this even like sometimes carried over to my own home. Like I'd even refuse to eat my rice with my hands at home because like my excuse was it was too hard. And the only times I'd eat with my hands would be when I visited my older relatives in India. And it was kind of like this reverse pressure to eat with my hands because now I was surrounded by everyone who ate with their hands. And
Mm.
I remember, like, I would feel like, okay, now I need to eat with my hands. And then my parents would look at me really weirdly and like make fun of me because they know that I never eat with my hands at home. And now
Yeah.
that I'm older, of course, I see things a lot differently. And I have a better appreciation and understanding of the cultural significance of eating with your hands, like how it brings you closer to your food and helps you focus more on what you're eating and on the people around you, which is like essential for like the communal eating culture in a lot of in Asian countries. So yeah, I feel like a lot of these like differences in the way we eat, what we eat, are like attributed to like the different cultures in Asia and like the difference between like Western culture, Asian culture, and just like bridging that gap of not understanding the differences.
Yeah, that process of like internalization that you're talking about, where you've been socialized in a place where you're like, oh, eating with your hands is uncivilized, it's dirty, it's messy, and I shouldn't be associated with those things because I need to be palatable. And then the way you get to internalize those feelings and then internalize that racism, basically, really relates to. Here's where I go on a spiel about my dissertation that I've just submitted, but
We love an educated girl.
self-exoticism like interests me endlessly. Like a lot of thing, like I mean the reason why eating with your hands, well, the reason I think why eating with your hands is seen as so like unmessy and uncivilized is that like, or just seen as a bad thing is that Asianness is acceptable when it's like clean and when it's palatable. And so there's a kind of aesthetic that needs to come with Asianness in order for it to be acceptable and cool and trendy, as opposed to like barbaric and irrational.
Oh, okay.
Like you need to have like banana leaves and stuff, you need to have chopsticks in your hair. And that kind of exoticism can be really easily internalized and forms a kind of self-exoticism. So that's a really complicated subject, so I'll just try and touch on it. But in many ways, self-exoticism can sort of be seen as a form of reclamation. So
Okay.
you're exoticizing yourself, you're fetishizing yourself
Oh, okay.
before somebody else can. So you're kind of inviting the expectation. It's kind of humorous in the process, and you're directly subverting the power dynamic. Like you've reclaimed the power by doing the
Okay.
process to yourself.
Okay.
And I think you see this in a lot of the humor of lots of like Asian comedians.
Oh,
But there's also simultaneously a kind of criticism that self-exoticism receives because, and this is something that Stuart Hall talks about in his lecture about about like representation in the media. But stereotypes are an attempt to fix meaning, is what Hall says,
Okay.
and an attempt to directly reverse these stereotypes in like a very simplistic, like direct inversion means you're just trying to fix the entirely opposite meaning. So you're being just as redundant because it's impossible to fix meaning in a kind of environment where we all think individually and we all have different lived experiences and we don't all interpret anything the same way. So one thing can never have one meaning. And so self-exoticism, which is a very like direct inversion of power dynamics and expectations and processes, don't really work as a form of like post-colonial reclamation because they're crucially failing in exactly the same ways as exoticism itself does. Well, that's what the kind of argument is around this. And so I know that personally when I see especially like East and Southeast Asian restaurants around me that are called like Dragon Fountain, like there's literally one 5 minutes from me called Dragon Fountain and Lucky Dragon and Dragons of Fortune and stuff like that, it really makes me feel some kind of way. I'm just like, I mean, to be fair, who's to say that these aren't born out of the minds of like Asian owners as opposed to being an actual internalization of Western exoticism and a subversion of it? Because it is true that like dragons and luckiness and fortune are really central to East and Southeast Asian culture, especially. But I don't know, it always feels a little bit weird to me to sort of buy into these things that are like stereotyped about you and to like self-exoticize in this kind of way. But can you like offer any experiences from your kind of South Asian perspective and like also from a US perspective because I'm in the UK.
Before I touch on that, though, I actually never realized, like, I never perceived restaurant names through the lens of self-exoticization before, but after like hearing you talk about it and then mention the examples of like Dragon Fountain, Lucky Dragon, Dragons of Fortune, I'm starting to realize that there are so many restaurants that serve East Asian, Southeast Asian food that do like play into those like stereotypes. Like I know there are restaurants in California, for example, like Golden Dragon, Zen Garden, like these very like prominent Asian symbols that are always put in the restaurant titles. And I never noticed that. So wow, that's mind blowing. That's mind blowing.
I'm blowing your mind in so many ways.
Yes, so many
Lunchables, ways. Fast Lunchables. And now restaurant names. What's next?
Yeah. but to answer your question about like South Asian culture, this is the first time I'm coming across like self-exoticization as like a term. So I'm not sure if this example completely applies, but in the idea of like playing into stereotypes before they can be used against you, the most prominent example I can think of is this idea where the only dish South Asian people eat is curry. Like that's like a really big stereotype, especially towards the South Asian community. Like when I was in elementary school and I was asked what I was eating for lunch, those times I'd bring ethnic food to school, I always found it easiest to just say like, oh, I'm eating curry and rice, or curry and quote unquote bread, which was really chapati or roti or a dish like that, which I did not have the energy to explain, but usually I would say curry and rice or something. And I always found it so complicated to tell people that I was eating chana masala or rajma or paneer, and then I'd have to explain what exactly that was, because they're not popular dishes. They're not normalized in like, at least in American culture. And I mean, I guess to some extent, most people already kind of knew that South Asian people eat curry. So like that was a fact to most people. South Asian people eat curry. So like when I said I had curry for lunch, it just made sense to them conceptually. Like, yeah, Indian people eat curry all the time. But the thing is, it's not just curry, is it? Like these dishes all have their own specific names, their own ingredients, their own preparation methods. Like butter chicken is different from chicken tikka masala, which is different from tandoori chicken. They're not all just curry, you know? But kind of like what you were saying with the East Southeast Asian restaurant names, I was kind of playing into that cultural stereotype of South Asian Indian people only eating curry because it was just more convenient for me to do so than to educate a bunch of 9-year-olds as to the nuanced differences between the hundreds of different curry and non-curry dishes in South Asian culture. So it's like a matter of like, do I want to expend the time and energy to like break this down for them, you know?
Precisely, yeah. I feel like so much of like the Asian like diasporic kid experience, not even kid, just like even now I find myself still doing it sometimes, is like a general attitude of like passivity or like just being passive. I don't know how you say that, but like letting them just say all you eat is curry, like, and all curries are the same, or like that they're even all classified as curries, and letting them pronounce your name wrong even though they very clearly pronounced it wrong, and like just letting them basically entirely invalidate your experience. And so reclamation is about no longer letting them just do that, and like being like, no, this is how you pronounce my name. This is what I'm actually eating. It's not just a curry.
It's like breaking out
But also, like you said, breaking out of it. And also like it's also, but it is about expending that energy, like you said, and that can be a lot to take on. That's why it's so difficult. That's why reclamation is not so easy.
Yeah, I think definitely when you're younger, especially, you're kind of perceived to be like the representative of your culture. And to like have that on the shoulders of like a 10-year-old kid, like, I just, when you're young, you can't really handle that. And while you were talking about passivity, I don't think I'm saying that right. Passivity? Passiveness.
Me neither. It's all right. Passiveness. This is a safe space.
It's like this culture of accommodation. Like you're like, I don't want to inconvenience people and I don't want to like make things difficult for other people. So I'm going to accommodate other people. And it's like, no, you deserve to be respected. You deserve to have your culture respected. And like, for God's sake, you deserve to have your name properly pronounced, you know, like,
oh my gosh. Yeah. And that like culture of accommodation is why we internalize things, right? We just internalize all these racist messages that we're socialized to believe because it's easier And it's better for others. You know, we can put others first by internalizing all these racist beliefs that they have. And when I think of like that process of internalization, another thing that I think of is what I used to think about like veganism and vegetarianism. Like, and I don't think this is a lone experience. Like, generally, I think veganism and vegetarianism is seen as this really white Western
Oh
concept,
my
even though
God,
it's emerged from India, even though
yes.
it's from Asia,
Preach,
specifically India.
yes.
Like I used to think that veganism was so out of reach for me. Like I wanted to be as plant-based as possible coming to uni because I sort of had this summer of just learning about all these industries and everything, well, specific to the West. And also I just like don't like handling raw meat. There's an element of that as well. Just like, but anyway, yeah. So upon like coming to uni and having more independence, I wanted to be as plant-based as I could. But all the models of vegetarianism and veganism that I saw were all these white Westerners on YouTube making what I eat in a days, and they were eating like chickpea salads and banana smoothie bowls for breakfast, chia seeds, so many hemp seeds, so much protein powder, and like these like self-proclaimed Buddha bowls. I don't know where that name
No,
came
no,
from,
no.
of like a bunch of raw veggies, like some roasted sweet potato, a random dressing,
That's
like.
celery.
And all of this felt so, yeah, celery. I hate celery. Sorry, I hate celery. And just this, like, this entire thing just felt so out of reach for me. And they just weren't the things that I was interested in eating because I hate celery, or that I wanted to cook or I wanted to make. But I came to a point, actually, like, fairly embarrassingly recently, where I realized that so much Asian food, especially South Asian food, and actually Southeast Asian food as well, is veggie or even vegan, like by itself, like
Yes,
or it's at
yes.
least easily adaptable. Like it's already veggie or
Yes,
vegan. Like my
yes.
cultural food has been veggie and vegan my whole life. And I was just looking in entirely the wrong places for inspiration.
Yes.
But yeah, I just, God, realizing that I'd internalized those things about veganism and vegetarian was just, it was like heartbreak. It was like Lunchables all over again nightmare, honestly.
The Maggie trauma, now the Lunchables trauma.
My God. Watch episode one for the Maggie noodle trauma. Anyway,
That
what are
one.
your opinions, Meghna, on all of
Oh
this?
my God. Thank you so much for asking. I have so many thoughts, especially about the appropriation of veganism and vegetarianism by Western and white culture. My thoughts about the appropriation of veganism and vegetarianism in the West, like, are really similar to how I feel about like yoga in the West. So on the one
Oh
hand,
my God.
yeah, and I know you're super into yoga too, so you have opinions about this as
Thoughts,
well.
thoughts. That's a whole episode. That's a whole episode.
On the one hand, I think it's like really cool to see something that's like a critical part of like your culture become widespread and popular in other countries, because it's like, oh hey, people are learning about and becoming aware of and appreciating this aspect of my culture, and that's like usually a good feeling. But then the line between appreciation and appropriation is like so slim. And a lot of people in the West, like, they incorporate like veganism, vegetarianism, and yoga into their lifestyles without understanding or appreciating the origins and cultural significance of those practices. Like, they just do it for the health benefits. And yeah, that's great. Sure, I'm happy that you're making healthier choices, but it's like, it's disappointing. It's like disappointing when you find out that it's like nothing more than that to them. Like, it's just a lifestyle change that people make because they want to be hip or trendy, or like they want to brag to their friends about how they're helping save the planet one less hamburger at a time. But like, the thing is, veganism and vegetarianism is like, it's more than a diet. It's more than something you do to lower your cholesterol or prevent cardiovascular disease. It has its roots in India, and it's specifically attached or like connected to the culture of nonviolence or ahimsa that's prevalent in Hinduism, Jainism, and Buddhism. And personally, I'm not a Jain or a Buddhist, so I can't testify for them. But in Hinduism, our beliefs of nonviolence like stem from this idea that everything is God and God is in everything. In Hindu culture, like, for example, we greet each other, we fold our hands in that prayer form, and we say namaste, which means I bow to you, because we're greeting the God in another person and they're greeting the God in us. And so we practice nonviolence because to hurt another person is to hurt the God in that person, to hurt God themselves. And that principle extends to animals as well, which is what motivates people to subscribe to vegetarianism and veganism in India, at least. So to be clear, I'm not saying that everyone who wants to pursue a vegetarian, vegan lifestyle or go to yoga classes needs to like convert to Hinduism, but it would just be nice if people like acknowledged where these practices came from and tried to understand like the core philosophy behind it, because it's just so important to people who are South Asian and Indian and Hindu.
That explanation was so nice. I feel like so warm and fuzzy after learning about like the God in others, like bowing down to the, oh, that is so cute and like nourishing and adorable. And I feel like what this is demonstrating is that generally, I won't say always, but generally there is a lack of depth in white Western understanding of Asian culture.
Mm-hmm.
Like, especially when it comes, like, not just to do with like veganism and vegetarianism, but also just Asian food more generally. Like, I feel like, for example, like Chinese and Indian foods, they're typically considered like cheap and easy hangover food.
Oh my God,
like, despite like the deep history and the preparation behind it. Like, the initial understanding of these kinds of foods is that they're great for when like you want something to get greasy and like something to cure your hangover.
Yeah.
And I could go into the whole discourse around the recent TikTok discourse around that British TikToker calling Chinese takeaway a Chinese and like that being objectifying or whatever. I have so many thoughts. We're not going to go into that right now. However, I feel like it really demonstrates this kind of overall idea around how white Western understanding of Asian food really doesn't have that depth, or at least how it like, yeah, how it just frames Chinese and Indian food, especially as just takeaway food.
No, I feel that so much. Like that was a beautiful way to put it, honestly. Like just the amount of people who just stay on the surface and don't try to understand like how significant these things are to people of those cultures. And I'm not going to say that I'm completely like out of the woods with that. I'm sure like I've done that too. But I think it's just a matter of realizing, acknowledging that you might be doing that and, you know, making steps to change that for yourself. But yeah, I definitely understand where you're coming from with like the common perception of Indian food. And I also like this idea of other countries, like how they perceive like Asian food and how they claim Asian food. Like we were talking about the appropriation of veganism and vegetarianism and like the appropriation of Asian food in general. Like the most prominent example I can think of right now is like, it's like the UK. Okay, I know you're from the UK, but I'm just gonna, I'm gonna take this moment, but in the UK, for those of you who may not know, in the UK, the UK's national food is chicken tikka masala. And let me tell you right now that that is definitely not a British food. That did not originate in the UK. That is a very, very South Asian, very, very Indian food. And honestly, I find it hilarious. I find it hilarious that they do this. But when you think about it through the lens of cultural appropriation, they literally took a food from a different culture and claimed it as their own national food. And I've read in articles about like politicians literally being like, this food is so prevalent in the UK that now we can call it our food. And I'm like, bro, do you know why it's so prevalent in the UK? Do you know why? Let me think.
Critical thinking, Caps.
No, but yeah, like, in all honesty, though, I really can't blame them. Like, if I had tasted garam masala after 200 years of eating nothing but raw toast, I, too, would culturally appropriate. But we are starting to break out of the culture of accommodation. We are starting to respect ourselves. So we are going to call out this and be like, no, you cannot claim my food as your own. So, yes, that's my New Year's resolution.
We need a moment for raw toast. You're so right. If after 200 years of eating raw toast, you didn't want some spice in your life. Who are you? You know?
No, yeah. Oh, like God.
That was a great one-liner. That's going straight on the Instagram. If it's not already there, it's going there.
Thank you.
But yeah, I feel like the overall trend we're seeing then is that like Asian food has to be Instagrammable. Like bubble tea and like mochi, like bento boxes, these are all acceptable forms of like trendy Asian food. Mm-hmm. But durian, which stinks, or like intestines, which look gross, or chicken feet, which a white person would never eat, like these things wouldn't make the cut, despite them being delicacies in the Asian world, even more so arguably than things like bubble tea, mochi, bento boxes.
Mm-hmm. I think this might tie into like what we were talking about before about like normalization of food. Like in the West, like I feel like there are certain Asian foods in the West that are perceived as palatable because they don't look like too quote unquote exotic. Like the foods you just mentioned, like I can't help but notice that they have like a vague resemblance to dishes that you could typically find in the West. Like I'm thinking like boba or bubble tea and mochi like have been turned into these massive trends. And like in middle school, I rarely ever saw a bubble tea or boba shop, but now they are everywhere in California. And I'm thinking it's the same thing in the UK.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, like in these last few They're years, everywhere. Like they have popped up everywhere. And like a lot of grocery stores that I go to now have some sort of mochi in the freezer aisle. And I cannot help but see how bubble tea parallels drinks that are already widespread and familiar in the West, like iced coffee or lattes and mochi. The mochi offering grocery stores, at least, is literally just ice cream, but with like a layer of like cake around it. So if people like iced coffee and they like ice cream, it's not like too much of a leap to try bubble tea and mochi. Mm. But when you don't have dishes that, like chicken feet, which are delicacies in Asia, obviously, but they don't have like a close parallel in Western cuisine because, you know, the West typically focuses on thigh meat and like breast meat. And like that, because it doesn't have that close parallel, it's seen as weird or gross. And people here just aren't used to seeing dishes like those served. So because they're unfamiliar and therefore unpalatable, it's like, okay, this is a really bad metaphor, but it's like the West is looking into Asia's lunchbox, pointing at all the things that it vaguely recognizes and saying, yeah, that looks good, I'll take that, and then just like throwing everything else away. You know what I mean?
No, yeah, I think that was a great metaphor, actually. I feel like that is perfectly encapsulating exactly how exoticism works. Like some scholars have sort of broken it down as when something is exoticized, when a person or a food in this case is being exoticized, that relies upon not just an element of like unfamiliarity and it being like this really different, like othered thing that like other communities, other societies do in other countries, but also it relies upon at least a certain degree of familiarity. Like that thing has to be at least to some extent also familiar and something that like the West can recognize itself in. Right. Because if it doesn't have that, then that exotic object would just be ugly or gross or weird. It wouldn't have that element of like interest. So there's a weird kind of like gross intrigue in things because they're like equal parts familiar and unfamiliar. I feel that really summarizes like the stuff around like mochi and like bubble tea and how we found a sort of middle ground in the West by creating recipes that like overlap with the two cultures.
Right.
And those are the things that are allowed to be trendy. But yeah, I feel like even like throughout this episode so far, when we've been saying like Asian food, Asian drinks, I just have so many qualms with like the descriptor Asian, because I feel like it's never, like it's the largest continent on earth, right? Asia is.
Yes.
And so to say Asian is, I feel like I can't think of a single situation where that's a suitable and like a precise enough term to use.
Right, right.
Like it, even like to go into like East Asian, Southeast Asian, South Asian, West Asian, even that at times doesn't feel precise enough. And so just to use this general descriptor of Asian never feels like it's very appropriate. But when you do search Asian food into Google, you're getting predominantly East Asian and Southeast Asian food results. You're not getting South or West Asian food. And like Asian food as a term is just so general, especially because, and that feels especially like an injustice, because food is, especially for like foodies like us, is like a really intimate and personal
Yeah,
thing.
for sure.
And it's this thing that creates connections between places and people and cultures and identities as a whole. But yeah, maybe let's talk about that then. Like, how does food create connections, and how is food this really intimate experience?
Okay, I'll start with me then. For me personally, I would say Indian cuisine is like a form of communication for me. Like, it's a way for me to connect to people, like, even across the world through a medium that we can both understand, despite the fact that we may not speak the same language, you know? So, like, even though I grew up in the United States, I can still make a connection with someone who grew up in South Asia, because we could both love and appreciate the same foods, even though we may not actually be able to speak to each other. And I would say food makes me feel really close to my family too, especially the family I rarely get to see because, you know, they're in India and I'm here in California. So when I go to India, I sometimes like I obviously like a lot of people who were born or raised in the West, I feel a little like, you know, out of place because I can't speak my native language. But when I'm sitting at the dining table eating, I've never felt out of place. Because even though I'm thousands of miles away from where I consider to be home, I'm eating the exact same foods. Like, I'm eating idli and I'm eating chapati and rice and dal with my hands and all the other foods that my mom makes for me all the time at home. And it's just the sense of instant belonging and connection when you're eating these foods. And those are feelings you can carry with you anywhere you go, as long as the food is there waiting for you. So the idea of Indian cuisine, Asian cuisine being this form of connection across like huge, vast distances and time and space, just like anywhere I am at any point in my life, if I'm eating chana masala, I will feel at home. And that's what Asian food,
Oh,
Indian food
so
means to
cute.
me.
You're right. Yeah, I feel like food is such a unifier, such a unifying experience. And that I definitely agree with that, in terms of my personal experience. Like, eating, especially when I'm back home in Malaysia, is eating, like, food is the reason that we have a social get together. Like, you won't catch us, like, going shopping. Like, that won't be the activity. Like, we're not gonna go shopping together. We're not gonna, like, plan a day around this trip or something. Like, the social get together is going to revolve around food. It's going to revolve around a meal or around, like, communal cooking. Like, back home in Malaysia, all we do is eat. Like, if we're visiting family that we haven't seen in ages, we're doing it over a meal. If we are touring a new place or having a sort of day out, we're touring this new place and having a day out through its food. And the first thing that we do every time we land after our, like, 18-hour, whatever it is, flight from the UK, our
Those
first stop
flights.
is a hawker center. So, like, these, like, giant outdoor food courts, for some roti canai, like, our favorite thing. And food is that great excuse to just bring us all together, especially, like you're saying, where there are barriers to communication. Like, I don't speak my home language.
I feel that. I feel
And that's
that.
why food is just. I could do a whole episode talking about my issues with the fact that I don't speak my home
Stop. I
language.
could join you. We could make an
I
entire
just,
season.
we could just sob right now, and we just won't. Let's not do that.
Thinking of what you
But
were
yeah,
talking
food is
about
such
with
a
food being
unifier.
this unifier, this formation of connection across time and space. Like, we also got some feedback and some points from our teammates who help us make the podcast. We have one of our teammates, our researcher, Annika. We love you. Annika told us about how like food is one of the only tangible connections we have to our heritage, which is something that I totally agree with. Like, she said that a lot of the dishes we cook at home, or that she cooks at home, are recipes that like, you know, daughters learn from their mothers. And I think she mentioned to us how there's this sweet that originates in Bengal called sandesh, and her grandmother preferred to make it with molasses. And so that's how her grandmother taught her mom, and then that's how she learned to make it. So that like generational tie, and how like you could make the same food in the same like quirky way that your ancestors made, and that's something unique to your family and your like subculture. So like you can literally see how that's unifying across time and space. And then we also got some feedback from another one of our team members, May. She told us how she didn't grow up eating Chinese food cooked by her family, so she learned to make Chinese food when she was older, and she learned to find authentic Chinese restaurants, and she ate with her Chinese friends, and that was a way for her to connect and understand her own cultural identity. And the way she talked about how, like, she didn't grow up surrounded by Chinese culture, but formed that connection on her own by, you know, exploring Chinese food and using food as, like an outlet for her cultural expression. So we can really see how food is just, like, such a foundation for Asian culture in general.
Yeah, food is such this connector between, like, the individual and their home culture, regardless of where they happen to be in the world.
Yeah.
I know that the stories that I've heard of my parents, who grew up in this like tiny fishing village in Malaysia, are quite defined by food. And I think that food in general is an integral part of any culture and any life in any place across the world. But like cooking and eating as this communal activity that depends on and family and sharing is something potentially quite unique to certain Asian countries. Like I'm speaking specifically for Malaysia when I say that people are pretty much always like eating out as opposed to cooking at home. Mm. But that means something very different to like when me and my friends here in the UK say we're like eating out. Uh-huh. Like when people are eating out in Malaysia, they aren't like going to restaurants necessarily. Like they're going to hawker centers, which are these massive food courts, basically, which have all these stores that have existed for decades, which are run by like generations and generations of the same family cooking the same recipes and feeding the same returning customers. Mm-hmm. So you aren't really eating out. Well, you are, but the food that you're eating out is home cooked, even if it's not from your own home. And it also isn't necessarily expensive at all. So yeah, that culture of hawker centers is really quite unique to certain parts of Asia, I think. But yeah, home is everywhere in a way because of that, because families are out on the streets and they're sharing their own family recipes with everybody.
Stop. That's so, sweet. Oh my god, that's so wholesome. Like that literally, you know how you were talking about the warm fuzzy vibes, I'm feeling them right here in my heart right now.
Oh, it's so warm. So warm and fuzzy. Okay, well, to continue on the warm and fuzzy high, let's seal the episode shut with a couple love letters to our lunch boxes. Meghna, tell me about your favorite food from your heritage, your culture, that reminds you of your childhood.
So I guess not Maggie, because we've already gone on that tangent. Okay, if I will say that the first dish that comes to mind is my dad's fish fry and pulisheri. So obviously we know what fish fry is. It's fried fish, specifically salmon. Salmon is the best fried fish. Oh my god. And then pulisheri is like this yellow buttermilk dish that you pour over rice, and it's very unique to Kerala, which is where my family's from. And growing up, I used to call it yellow sauce, which we're not going to talk about. We're not going to talk about that, how that was whitewashed. And okay, yeah. So I love, 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 love my dad's fish fry and pulisheri. Like, I don't know what he put in that, like, that like coating. I don't know what you call it when you like the spice coating that you put on the fish before you fry it. Don't know what he put in that, but it was so good. And I just loved how the spices in the fish like blended with the coolness and creaminess of the buttermilk from the pulisheri. And I haven't had it in so long, and I would kill for it.
That sounds so good.
It was.
Wow. I love how like that's the kind of thing that you've like loved since you were a kid, because I definitely had foods that I didn't love when I was growing up, but I do love them now. Like tofu is a really good example of this, because I really didn't like it as a kid. The main form I sort of had it in, actually, I don't even know if I ever even tried it when I was a kid. I was like that picky when I was small, but was like in this kind of like scramble that would be a part of like one of the many dishes that we would put inside of our popiah, which is like our spring rolls. Like Malaysian style, so they're not like fried or anything. They're like, I don't know if you'd call them raw. I'm pretty sure they're not raw, but they're like not fried or baked or anything. But yeah, that was the form of tofu I was like encountering, and I just was not loving it. But now I love tofu, especially like the fried puffs, my favorite, or like marinated tofu, or yeah, character development. Because I also now do that thing where you like freeze a block of tofu and then thaw it out and then freeze it, thaw it, freeze it, thaw it. And then the texture just goes so cool. Like that process of freezing does something to the texture, and now I really love that kind of tofu.
Oh.
But yeah, there's my character arc. Is there anything like that for you where you like hated it when you were a kid, but you love it now?
I wouldn't go so far as saying love, but there was this one food that my mom would make for me. I think the first time she made it for me was like in middle school, but it's called bavakya, or bitter gourd. I honestly don't know what vegetable this is, but she would basically like, I think, fry it or something. And I remember the first time I ate it, I had like a visceral, violent reaction to it. I was like, this is disgusting. I do not like this. What is in my mouth right now? Oh my God, I did not react well. But like after like my mom was like, you have to eat this. This is a vegetable. It's healthy. So she just kept making it for me. And I guess I like adapted to it. But like after a while, like I don't know, I just began like appreciating it more. Like there was like a very specific flavor like component to it that when my mom would cook it like until it was crispy and slightly smoky, and then like if I paired it with something slightly sweet like beetroot or like some sort of lentil curry, like it would just like blend or it would just mesh pretty well. So it was actually not that bad, but like that did take like a couple times for me to like develop a taste for it. But yeah, I would say my mom was definitely a big influence in that. Like she was the one who would like keep making it for me, and then from there I like just developed like a taste for it. So like, you know, my parents are probably like the biggest like influences in my life when it comes to food. So what about you?
Yeah, I feel like, I guess we can call them food mentors, but I would agree that my like biggest mentors in relation to like food were my parents as well. Like I've now just finished uni and I'm graduating soon, but when I used to be like constantly traveling back and forth between like uni at term time and then like during the holidays going back to like near London, I would always make sure that I was like asking and writing down family recipes that I could cook while I was at uni because I just missed them so much. But I actually found it was really funny learning from my parents, like individually, because they are so different as cooks. We have got this running joke that my dad can't make the same dish twice. Like he's always adding and mixing things up and using whatever we have on hand at that precise moment. So like a recipe from my dad isn't really something you can replicate. Whereas my mom is a lot more like tidy and precise, and she knows her recipes down to a T, and if I follow what she's given me, it will turn out the same. Oh no, that's a lie. I feel like the mum touch really does something. But like I'm more likely to achieve the right result and like achieve the level of my mum's cooking rather than my dad's, because my dad's is just like he's out on another level. But yeah, I really like being a sort of a compromise between my mum and my dad, and they've been such mentors for me, which is so wholesome. But yeah.
Wait, so recommend a food then? Like, 'cause like I mean, I personally am not super into cooking yet, but like it seems like you have experience in the kitchen. So like is there like a certain food that you would recommend for like all of our podcast listeners out there to try?
Oh my God, that's so hard because my instinct is to say char kway teow, which is this like flat rice noodle stir fry. And it's like one of my favorite Malaysian dishes. But it's also really hard to like replicate and make yourself. Well, I found that at least. I feel like the charcoal in Malaysia, when it's cooked on that, does something to the flavor because I just can't make it taste the same. I can make it taste good, but it won't be the same. But I would still recommend it, or to like try it out somewhere. You also can't go wrong with like nasi lemak, which is like coconut rice with like a fried chicken and or like a curry chicken, and then like peanut sambal, like fried anchovies,
Oh, anchovies, huh?
and like a bit of cucumber. Yeah, different elements. Or with the summertime approaching, ice kacang, like our shaved ice.
Ooh,
Oh, I'm gonna stop talking because I could go on about ice kacang for years, like actual years, but. Yeah, what would you recommend?
Okay, I know I keep plugging chana masala as one of the best Indian dishes ever, but that's okay because it is. So I would recommend chole bhatura or chana bhatura, because like okay, you won't find anything as amazing as my mom's, or maybe you will, who knows, but every quality Indian restaurant, whether it's vegetarian or non-vegetarian, will have chana bhatura. It's basically like chana masala, which is that chickpea curry, with bhatura, which is like a puri, but it's like thicker, more bready, softer. So yeah, if you go to an Indian restaurant, you will definitely find that on the menu, and I would definitely recommend. It's like always my go-to whenever I just need like a pick-me-up or anything. So, oh, and Annika, our amazing researcher, shout out to her. She has also recommended a dish for all of you to try. It's the dish of many names. It's called Pani Puri. It's called Golgappa. It's called Pani Ked. It is the most refreshing and superior snack to have, according to Annika. So if you go to an Indian restaurant, it's also like a snack food, street food, super easy to eat. You just kind of crack open the shell of the pani puri, put in like the liquid water-based component, and then you eat it in one big bite. So def recommend pani puri on behalf of Annika.
I've seen clips of this legendary dish of many names, as Annika's put it. And I have to try it. It looks so good.
It's so fun to eat too. Like it is.
I don't know where yeah, it looks so fun to eat. Oh my god! I'll get my hands on some and I will review it for the next episode. Wait, that's a really big promise. Maybe I won't do that. I'll try. Anyway, it was so nice to talk about all of our food memories today. That was very wholesome, and I'm really glad that we've ended on a very happy note, just recommending people food. And not talking about food-related trauma, which is very nice. But yeah, so excited to share our future episodes in the season with all of you guys so that we can continue talking about food, which is our favourite thing to talk about here as foodies.
Yeah.
But make sure you join us next time. Make sure you listen to the previous episode, if you haven't already. Isabel and Naina are talking about tea with a lovely guest.
Definitely.
And the one before as well, where Meghna talks about her Maggie noodle trauma, which you really need to know if you don't already know. But yeah, join us next time. We will see you later, guys.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Love you.